Hello and welcome to DAC Beechcroft's Lawcast. I'm Kerry Fuller, a legal director in the Employment, Pensions and Immigration team. And this is the first episode in the first series of our podcast about the Employment Rights Act 2025, as it now is. Our previous podcasts about the bill before the Act received royal assent are still on our website. But today I'm joined by partners Richard Loxley and Steve Ellaby and senior associate Rose Jakeman. Welcome all.
Hi, Kerry.
Hi. So in today's podcast, we're going to be discussing the unfair dismissal measures in the Employment Rights Act 2025, and in particular, the implications of the right to bring an ordinary unfair dismissal claim becoming subject to a six-month qualifying service period, quite a reduction, and attracting unlimited compensation with the lifting of the compensation cap. So Rose, could you tell us a little bit more about these changes, please?
Yeah, of course, Kerry. So listeners may well remember that before the last general election, the government committed in its manifesto to make protection from unfair dismissal a day one right by removing the current 2-year qualifying period for unfair dismissal claims. However, in a surprise announcement on 27th of November 2025 that I think took us all a bit by surprise, the government dropped this commitment in favour of a 6-month qualifying service period and also said that they would be lifting the cap on the unfair dismissal compensatory award. In the last few days of the Employment Rights Bill's passage through Parliament, the House of Lords tried to intervene. They noted that the impact of removing the cap hadn't been subject to proper parliamentary scrutiny, but in the end, the House of Commons prevailed, and this is where the Act landed.
Thank you, Rose. And Richard, are you able to tell us when these changes are coming into force?
Yeah, sure. The government has confirmed it intends to make regulations this year to bring the 6-month qualifying period into effect from the 1st of January 2027. Now, there are no transitional provisions, so this means that any employee who's dismissed with an effective date of termination on or after the 1st of January 2027 will have the right to bring an unfair dismissal claim, provided they've got at least 6 months service as at their effective date of termination. Now, the lifting of the cap on unfair dismissal compensation awards will apply to dismissals with an effective date of termination on or after the 1st of January 2027.
Great, thank you. And just so listeners are completely clear about what's happening, Steve, are we still expecting a consultation on unfair dismissal and the concept of an initial period of employment?
Thanks, Kerry. The answer to that is no, we're not. So the original proposal of day one protection from unfair dismissal would have involved a concept of a quote-unquote initial period of employment, during which a lower level of protection would apply. However, this will not be taken forward with a move to the new 6-month qualifying period in the alternative.
Okay, thanks, Steve. And sticking with you for a moment, could you tell our listeners what impact you expect the change to the qualifying period to have, please?
Yes, of course. And it's not good news for employers, I'm afraid. The change to 6 months brings an increased risk of claims. And there's a couple of key points I wanted to mention in this regard. Firstly, employees with much shorter service will be able to bring claims for unfair dismissal, which is likely to increase the volume of unfair dismissal tribunal cases. At the moment, it's relatively straightforward to limit an employee who has under 2 years service to their notice pay if their employment is terminated and there's no basis for, say, a discrimination or whistleblowing claim. Secondly, listeners will also remember that there's going to be an increase in tribunal time limits from 3 to 6 months, which is expected no earlier than October of this year. So coupling this with only needing 6 months service means that employers are likely to face significantly higher numbers of claims than they have done to date.
Mm-hmm. And Richard, is there any upside at all in this for employers?
Well, it's theoretically possible that the 6-month qualifying period, coupled with the removal of the cap on unfair dismissal compensatory awards, will lead to a reduction in the number of employees who seek to dress up unfair dismissal claims as claims for whistleblowing or discrimination. And that's currently a tactic used essentially to get around the 2-year qualifying service requirement or to seek to recover higher compensation than is available for ordinary unfair dismissal. However, my view is that in reality, the removal of the cap will simply open up a remedy to a whole new category of more complex and expensive claims from high earners who previously would have settled any unfair dismissal claim as part of an agreed exit package.
Okay, do you mind elaborating on that a little bit more for our listeners, please?
Yes, certainly. So if we take a senior exec with salary, pension, bonus, some form of equity, with a cap on compensation for unfair dismissal in place, and obviously absent any allegations of discrimination or whistleblowing that Steve has mentioned, a settlement package based on notice, compensation at or near the unfair dismissal cap, and an agreement that they'd be treated as a good leaver for the purpose of share schemes is quite a standard thing to see in practice. Mm-hmm. Now, the removal of the cap on unfair dismissal widens the potential settlement range considerably and is likely to make it much harder to manage expectations. And I think this expectation gap may mean that more claims are litigated than are resolved at an early stage. So in addition to well-paid executives, those with significant pension arrangements or incentives, those whose dismissal potentially has long-term career impact, and I guess those approaching retirement age with a period of extended loss of earnings, will from the 1st of January 2027 be much more likely to find issuing an unfair dismissal claim an attractive option.
Thanks, Richard. And we're going to come on later in this podcast to discuss losses in a bit more detail. But Steve, practically, could you tell our listeners about sort of ideas regarding steps employers can take to perhaps limit the unfair dismissal claims themselves, please?
Yeah, sure. So while the change applies to all reasons for dismissal, of which hopefully our listeners will be aware that there are five, and that also includes redundancy, what I'm going to mention today is steps that are relevant more to performance dismissals, as we think this is where the real challenges will come from. So first of all, employers need to be really confident that they're getting the right people in by using robust recruitment and onboarding processes. For senior execs, any disciplinary and grievance procedures ought to be amended to allow some flexibility to reflect the executive level seniority or more senior staff members. And also, of course, while complying with the ACAS code of practice, which has not been amended, and in a world where compensation for unfair dismissal is uncapped, an uplift of 25% for failing to follow the code could be in the future very significant indeed, more than the current cap alone, although the code ought to be applied proportionately. There will need to be a more consistent and robust approach to management during probationary periods as well. And probation processes must be completed before that 6-month window where the unfair dismissal rights will now kick in as of next year on 1 January 27, allowing for at least 1 week statutory notice as well. So therefore, a formal check-in and assessment in the midway point through the probationary period should be adopted. And employers should be careful to keep a clear record of this, as well as any other discussions that might take place that relate to performance. There will also need to be a more robust approach to performance management too, with appraisals and accountability for measurable objectives throughout the relevant year. For those organisations looking to manage out employees, documents showing the relevant reason for dismissal, adherence to policies relevant to that reason, or reasons why policies weren't followed, such as delays, will be really important. And process is going to be really under scrutiny in the new order. And managers will also need to understand that if they are taking a decision to dismiss an employee who has 6 months service from January 2027, that this carries more risk. And so HR may stress test that decision a bit more than before, for example, by exploring alternatives to dismissal, such as warnings and chances to improve performance, and whether the documents reflect the decision making and so on. We also think this is going to be really hard with the advent of AI, as we're seeing this used in grievances and data subject access requests or DSARs, as well as throughout disciplinary processes. So it can be really hard for employers not to get bogged down and make mistakes.
Thanks, Steve. So, I mean, that was a bit of an unfair question, really, because I asked you what steps employers can take to limit the claims themselves. And of course, if someone wants to issue a claim, they will issue a claim. But those are all really helpful suggestions for how perhaps if someone goes and takes legal advice, they might be told they don't have a claim of much merit. And thinking about the merit of claims, Richard, has anything changed in respect of the legal test that tribunals will apply to see whether there's been an unfair dismissal?
I mean, Kerry, the answer to that is no. Claims of ordinary unfair dismissal, which are issued on or after 1st of January next year, the tests will remain the same. The impetus is on the employer to prove the reason for dismissal as it always has been.
And what does that involve?
Well, as listeners may know, this involves a factual analysis by the employment tribunal of what happened. And this occurs at a full tribunal hearing. So as listeners are probably acutely aware, the tribunal system is creaking at the moment. In some parts of the country, cases are now being listed well into 2028. So an uptick in claims, both arising from the shorter qualifying period and the need for more complex remedy hearings following the lifting of the compensation cap, is inevitably going to place further strain on tribunal resources, potentially leading to even longer resolution times. So I think that's one lever employers will have in negotiating with high earners or those claiming significant losses. Ultimately, they'll have to wait a long time to see any compensation if the tribunal finds in their favour. So, of course, they may well have the means to wait, but they may not have the patience or indeed the appetite to do so.
Thank you, Richard. So we've thought a bit about who's likely to bring uncapped claims in the new order and some steps that can be taken to avoid giving an employee a successful unfair dismissal claim. We're going to think a little bit now about the arguments employers will be deploying to limit any losses. And Rose, can I bring you back in here, please? Could you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, of course, Kerry. So the employer's arguments will be about failure to mitigate, Polki deductions, in other words, when the tribunals reduce compensation on the basis of what would have happened had a fair procedure been adopted, and contributory fault. And it's also worth adding, I mean, we were having this discussion in advance of this conversation, but at the moment, because of the cap, in high value cases, Polki arguments can be of little relevance because a very high earner will get to the cap very quickly. But in the new order, we're likely to see Polki and contributory fault arguments taking on much more importance because the precise reductions will have a very real impact on total compensation.
Thanks, Rose. So on failure to mitigate, do we expect to see employers adding adverts or alternative roles to remedy hearing bundles as evidence of this lack of mitigation?
It can't harm, but I think for some very senior roles, it's more likely that evidence will be needed from headhunters about the relevant recruitment markets, which again adds to complexity and to cost. And while on the subject of expert evidence at tribunals, employers are also more likely to need to call pension and benefits specialists too. And we're going to see those taking on more importance in the remedy stage of these hearings. And this is yet another area where cost may well be added to litigation as a result of lifting the cap.
Thanks, Rose. And Steve mentioned following processes. But of course, following processes can be time consuming, and that's where the cap's currently helpful. And certainly if someone's very senior in the business, a decision maybe need to dismiss them faster than a process allows. What are the options here, Rose?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, this is going to be of real importance for a lot of businesses. And I think taking a different approach for senior executives is a point the Employment Tribunal has some sympathy with. And I think this may be an area where we see some development going forward and in light of these changes. So in the recent case of Zen Internet and Stobart, which involved a dismissal with no process of a former chair of the company who had moved into the CEO role. Both the tribunal and the EAT noted the relevance of the claimant's seniority. So they commented that for a CEO, performance is based on the performance of the organisation they lead, acknowledging wider factors than individual performance in the basis of a dismissal. And widening the net still further, they acknowledged that those in senior management positions may be fully aware of what's required of them and fully capable of judging their own achievements. So the EAT said quite helpfully that exceptionally, warning and opportunity for improvement are of no benefit to the employee and may be an unfair burden on the business. So I think a helpful comment there. Although in this case, the employer hadn't followed their own procedure in a number of respects. So the EAT agreed that the dismissal was unfair. And that comes back to Steve's point earlier about amending policies for your senior executives to give flexibility around procedure. And the Zen case also looked at Polkey. So importantly, the EAT said that Polkey arguments do not need to be confined to a window after the dismissal. And for very senior, well-paid individuals, using Polkey to limit losses to the dismissal date by pointing to informal conversations may be useful in persuading the tribunal when someone would have been dismissed had a fair process been followed. And this is particularly so for those who are so senior, they ought to know if they're performing at the level expected of them. In the Zen case itself, the EAT found that the capability issue had in effect crystallised several weeks before the dismissal when the company chairman emailed the CEO to say he'd lost confidence in his ability to lead the business back to profitability. And the EAT remitted the case back to the tribunal to assess Polkey, noting that the tribunal should have analysed why a fair procedure could not have been completed in the weeks between the date of that particular email and the notice of dismissal, and therefore whether a Polkey reduction could be applied to reflect that, rather than the original tribunal finding that it would have taken another 2 months to dismiss from the dismissal date. And we expect this area of law to be tested more in the years ahead.
Thanks, Rose. So it was going to need to be more of a focus on showing perhaps what would have happened rather than what did happen. And tribunals often refer to that as the counterfactual, Richard. Have you got any comments for us about how clients can prove the counterfactual, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky question because I think it's always hard to prove by definition a counterfactual. And so much is going to come down to individual findings that the tribunal makes at a liability phase. But each piece of litigation will need to be considered on its own merit. I think one potential dividing line for how much effort to put into mounting evidence to show the counterfactual, i.e. when someone would have been dismissed had a fair process been followed, will be to really think hard about the likelihood of the employer establishing a fair reason for dismissal. So if a claim is likely to be lost substantively because an employer will struggle to establish that they got a fair reason for dismissal, for example, in cases where poor performance has been masked by a redundancy or where no work whatsoever has been done to inform an employee that they are not performing to the standards required, then I think in reality a tribunal is unlikely to be with an employer seeking to establish that a Polkey deduction should be made. However, where a fair reason for dismissal is likely to be established, then I think the level of compensation is likely to be set to a material degree by Polkey arguments about the timing of a fair dismissal. For instance, if someone is sacked for clear gross misconduct, but let's say the employer's rushed the process or it's failed to give the right to be accompanied, a tribunal is likely to be with the employer on conduct as being the fair reason for dismissal. So in those circumstances, the employer may well be able to successfully argue that a fair process would only have taken a couple of weeks extra, for example, and that the employee would then have been fairly dismissed at that point. I think employers may also be able to argue that employees wouldn't have got a bonus as they were subject to a disciplinary action on the bonus payment date, provided that the bonus rules state that's a factor to be taken into account. They may argue that misconduct sits squarely within the share or plan rules to render someone a bad leaver. But essentially, there'll be much more to play for in reducing losses where there is unfairness only by virtue of a procedural defect. I still think if there's substantive unfairness, it's likely that trying to prove a counterfactual won't get much traction with the tribunal. And perhaps spending money on adducing evidence won't ultimately be a worthwhile exercise.
Okay, so doing some work to sort of shore up that exactly. fair reason, if it's not, you know, gross misconduct where the claimant does the work for you, yeah. Will be important. Thank you. And I said we'd talk a bit more about loss. So let's have a little think about how claims for loss of incentives, such as bonus and equity, might now be claimed in unfair dismissal claims once the cap is lifted. Steve, can I ask you about that, please?
Yeah, thanks, Kerry. So again, it seems to us that if a tribunal is with the employer on the substantive reason for dismissal, that they're going to be more likely to listen to arguments that a bonus would not have been paid to the employee. The employee will need to show that they have a reasonable expectation that the bonus would have been paid. It seems to us that if the bonus is contractual and the employee has hit the relevant targets and milestones in the particular scheme year, for example, then the employer is likely to have an uphill struggle arguing that there was no loss. If, however, on the other hand, the bonus is discretionary, then there may be some more scope. What we think is that this is going to involve looking at specific drafting of any bonus clauses and plans, as well as, at a minimum, the following. So firstly, the payment history and whether a bonus has, for example, been paid every year and at what sort of level. Secondly, what the policy is designed to reward, whether it's loyalty or performance, and whether that's based on company or individual performance or both. Thirdly, what other factors are set out in the bonus policy, for example, not being under any disciplinary investigation. And then finally, in some sectors and positions, whether there's any malice in the behaviours, such as fraudulent behaviour, which might well entitle employers to invoke the malice and clawback provisions, which are sometimes in employment contracts and particularly for more senior individuals. We take the view as well that the good documents and governance around bonus awards will be absolutely crucial, not only in terms of disclosure for a remedy hearing, but also to show that any discretion has been exercised reasonably and appropriately by the employer. I think I'll leave this one to Rose to say next more about the equity piece, given that her background comes from an employment incentive lawyer position.
Thanks, Steve. And it's really a similar point here, I think, that the tribunal's views on the merits of the claim itself are really likely to feed into their approach on equity. However, having thorough plan rules and clear provisions dealing with termination and treatment of equity will be important in terms of quantum for compensation awards. For instance, is the boundary between a good leaver and a bad leaver clear? The more woolly it is, the better able an employee will be to argue that they should be treated as a good leaver. Similarly, malice and clawback provisions ought to be included in the plan rules and drafted carefully to protect the business in circumstances where, for example, misconduct is identified after the date of an award. Employers should also think about vesting periods and also the timing of any dismissal in terms of vesting or exercising of options. And I say this because if a dismissal is carried out without a process and very close to a vesting or exercise date, particularly one which might be extremely valuable, we can see that this might plant suspicion in a tribunal's mind as to the employer's motive and the reason for dismissal. One point I think that's absolutely certain is that the removal of the cap is going to mean that these questions, and also questions around valuation mechanisms, dividends, deferral, etc., are going to be posed in many more cases. And unfortunately, this is going to add cost and we suspect lead to increased pressure on an already struggling tribunal system.
Thank you, Rose. So there's some overlap there with Polkey arguments, but I just want to check, Richard, that substantively, if an employer loses a claim and we're looking at equity and bonus loss, then clear drafting, proper exercise of discretion and records to explain what would have happened is going to be relevant to that loss in particular, not just because of Polkey arguments.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. The terms of a bonus or a share scheme are going to be relevant to the timing of the dismissal for Polkey arguments, but also for showing bonus or equity would not have been paid in the event of a substantively unfair dismissal too.
Thank you. And my final question is that we've mentioned a couple of times more complex remedy hearings. What do you think about senior execs applying for anonymity applications to prevent them being tarred for suing, which is sometimes, you know, a deterrent to suing because you don't want your name out there in the public domain?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think it's fair to say that anonymity applications are certainly on the rise. Interestingly, in the tribunal's preliminary hearing agendas, which are essentially a case management hearing early on the life cycle of a claim, there's a new box which invites claimants to tick whether they're seeking to make anonymity orders, which is new. So there's increased visibility for individuals litigating on that issue. But I think there is still a pretty high bar to be met, and anonymity orders are difficult to get. So I don't think this is an answer for an exec looking to sue and not be on the official public record. But I also think there's something for respondents to think about too, particularly at an early stage in proceedings, especially where there's going to be lots of financial data on bonus and equity, which could be revealed in a public hearing if there's no restricted reporting orders or anonymity orders in place.
Thanks, Richard. And thanks, everyone. Before we close, I just want to make our listeners aware of another development for the Employment Rights Act 2025, which was that on the 3rd of February, the government published an update to its implementation roadmap. And while most of the implementation timetable remains the same, it's worth listeners noting that industrial action on electronic and workplace balloting are now not expected to come into effect before August 2026. So that's been pushed back. And also the fire and rehire restrictions have been delayed until January 2027. And listeners can see all this using our ERA tracker and the timeline on our website. So I'd just like to say thanks again, Steve, Richard and Rose, for joining us and analysing the issues that will be before the employment tribunals next year as a result of the changes to unfair dismissal and particularly the lifting of the cap. In terms of other ERA 2025 measures, we're hosting a live webinar on the 11th of March on the trade union industrial relations measures. So do sign up to that through our website if you'd like to. But for now, though, thank you for listening. Thank you, Steve, Richard, Rose, for your insights. Thanks, everyone. Bye for now.